When we don't understand how our emotions shape our thoughts and decisions, we become disembodied from our own experiences and disconnected from each other. Brené Brown. Bending Not Breaking, The Dragon Pod, Reflections. Welcome back to another episode of Bending Not Breaking. This is Ben Pruitt, your host for this podcast, and I am so excited that we have been able to talk about all of the various reflections that we've been able to get guests for, and I'm excited to release this one because this reflection is intense. Today we are talking about Deep Below, and that means we're focusing on Ezrin, but I could not do it alone, so I secured an incredible guest, and I'd love to introduce you to Kuno. Kuno uses she, her pronouns and has been a fan of the Dragon Prince since before the show premiered, which is for her a first and very exciting because I don't know that I've ever been a show or a fan of a show before it premiered. So this is really exciting to have that much lineage to talk about. They are an artist, writer, designer, and when it comes to the Dragon Prince, Kuno is the author of Sides of the Moon, a Canon Divergence Raylan fanfic that is one of the, in metrics wise, one of the most read fanfics about the Dragon Prince. So Kuno, welcome to the podcast. I am thrilled to have you. How are you doing today?
Oh, I'm rolling. I'm okay. Thank you for having me, Ben. It's exciting to be here. I don't know if I think I've been interviewed once before, but I'm like, oh, it's always nice. It's always nice.
Yeah, it's nice to be wanted.
Exactly. It's nice to be wanted. And so I appreciate you inviting me and letting me be here with you.
Oh, it's my pleasure. So we heard a little bit about you through your bio, but tell us just a little bit about you. What makes you human? What makes you you?
God, I hope you can't hear the vacuum outside my door, but I am probably a storyteller by heart. That's kind of, I remember when I was, I think my first memory, like as a person, not from like TV, as a human being, is Sailor Moon. Was Sailor Moon. So
yes.
Yeah. And since then I've always, I grew up a lot on anime and manga. And since then I have always in general, I was an artist before I was a writer, and I've always kind of grown into storytelling, wanting to tell stories. I've done a lot of that mostly through fan fiction, though I'm trying to kind of go into original now as well, because I don't want to abandon fan fiction, especially in our day and age. I write and draw in whatever little spare time I have, because I am a grown adult with a full-time
responsibilities. Yeah.
With a full-time job and responsibilities, and I'll be 30 next year, I'll be 30 next year. So that'll be a thing. But, and granted, 30 is still young, but it's still another, you know, I've gone through my 20s and yep. I've made my mistakes in my 20s and I've done my stuff. So now I want to do it better going into my 30s.
I get it. As a 32-year-old, I get it. Two grown adults talking about a cartoon. And it's awesome. How cool is that? That this is something that we get to do.
Yeah, honestly, it's that, like, people think that, like, yeah, oh, you know, especially sometimes today, weirdly enough, the pandemic has swung so far that sometimes, you know, we're almost right back where we used to be. But it's it's like, I am 30 years old. I'm allowed to like cartoons, especially cartoons nowadays, which are really not, and they have never been, but are really not just for kids. Realistically speaking, a lot of people, they have a target audience, but a lot of people know that adult fans are the people going to consume these things because we're the ones with money. We're the ones going to spend it. Mm-hmm. Teenagers and kids don't have money. They have parents who can spend money, but those are different things. So, metrically speaking, they know that a lot of fandoms nowadays, especially in animation, have adult fans.
Yes. And I think that's what's so cool about these reflections, right? Is that, you know, quoting Devin on several places, she has said that these reflections are geared towards the adult audiences more so than the kids who are watching it on Netflix. And it shows in the content of these reflections, like they are hard hitting in terms of like high emotional bandwidth. And it's very intense. So I think we're going to get into that today. It's very exciting. So I would love to know specifically how you became a fan of the Dragon Prince before you even saw it. How did that happen? How does one do that, generally speaking?
By accident. So basically, anybody who knows Words with Dragons or in the Dragon Prince specifically, Raylan with two A's, them and their partner, I've known for a very long time. Dragons is one of my best friends, basically. And they were getting into the Dragon Prince. We were all kind of starting to, I don't say lean away, but you know, it'd been 5 years since Korra was ended. We were big Kynora fans, still are. And so they started, and Aaron Ehaz, they saw that, and obviously Dragon Prince was marketed as, you know, from the creators of Avatar The Last Airbender and the Uncharted series. And so of course they took interest in that. And so I just see this new thing kind of start coming onto my dashboard on Tumblr. And so I kind of I noticed, and then it didn't take super long before my interest was piqued, and I kind of just followed followed them into the fandom, and you know, out of curiosity, just to check it out. And what really, really sold me was Runon. And I remember it's probably still up there, it was a pre-show kind of marketing post where they were like, where it was his quote where he says, what does he say? He says, "We take life, but you know, life is precious, life is valuable. We take it, but we do not take it lightly." And that sold me on him. It saw us on top of him being, you know, of course, a tall, white-haired, you know, elf. It was like, you know, basically the show's Sesshomaru in some ways. So
I thought about that. Oh, that's an interesting comparison.
Yeah, you know, you have that trope of that character who's, you know, the cool white-haired character who's, you know, badass and can beat anybody, and that sort of thing. So that was Runon, and but that quote really got me, and I was sold. And so I was there at the beginning, towards the latter half of the beginning, but I was there for like the pre-show stuff. Remember
all the lead up to it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I remember that's a throwback for me too, I guess. Like I remember when I was a very early adopter. So as soon as it aired, I was like, I'm going to watch that. And I think I watched it the day it released. If not within the first couple of days, but it feels like I watched it very early on. But I was definitely not pre-show for sure. So that's a cool thing to be able to claim. That's super neat. Well, let's talk about this reflection that we've got going on here with Ezrin. But before we do, we want to center ourselves on the lens that we're going to be kind of reading this reflection through. And I asked you, what do you want to focus on? What is the thing that bubbles up for you as you read this? And you came up with this lens of emotion, specifically thinking about Ezrin's, but like, we're going to expand that a little bit, but like, how did you come up with this? Why emotion as the lens?
So one of the things especially with Ezrin, and I see a lot of different opinions on the Dragon Prince, especially over the past 5 years. And now I see it a lot in like the Discord and stuff in general, just everywhere, to some degree. But there's this idea that Ezrin, sometimes I find this idea that Ezrin isn't affected by everything going on, because he's kind of got this happy-go-lucky thing about him. And it's and for me, his emotions are important because like those are active choices. Those are not, this is a 12-year-old kid who became king at 10. He should not be doing this. And the idea that kind of it doesn't affect him isn't it, and so I'm glad this came out, isn't true at all. Like, it's not even just, oh, he's sad for a moment. It's like, you know, we don't need to see every moment of this torturous thing about him. Like, it really, like, I don't know how to explain it, but it's almost like the fact that he is king at 12 is the tragedy. That is the tragedy. You should not be. You shouldn't be having to do that. And so can you imagine? Because sometimes it's not even that, like, the torturous kind of sad emotions, it's how it changes him as he grows up, because at 10, 12 years old, he has to think about different things that other 10 and 12 year olds are not thinking about. Like, other 10 and 12 year olds are getting traumatized in middle school. He has to think about the peace of not just his own nation, but of multiple nations, and what it means, what his decisions mean, and how, and by extension to emotion, how he feels about Zubei, about everything, and all the other dragons and everything. He has to, like, how he feels about them, that affects the nations and the future of those nations. He has to think about that.
Yeah, one of the things that comes up for me as you talk is this idea of, if it's not on screen, then is it real? And I don't mean to say that, like, or in a reflection, or if it's not given to us on a silver platter, then is it real? Meaning, I agree with you in that it feels like there is perhaps a lack of imagination / a lack of empathy from the audience to be able to see that those emotions are very much there, and that's guiding and prompting and living with Ezrin and guiding his decisions, right? I feel like that's a pretty common critique I hear. One of the things I hear about Ezrin is that, like, almost a quote Mary Sue complex of that he's like this child king that can do no wrong and is always good and doesn't ever mess up and that kind of stuff. And I think that what you're pointing to is this idea that emotions are a really important thing to pay attention to as we kind of navigate his choices. And I think that's going to be really helpful for us. Does that resonate with you? Is that right?
Yes, I actually... Dragons, if you're listening, I'm stealing this from you. And we're probably gonna talk about it later. But what a character doesn't say is probably more important than what a character does say. You actually don't need, most people get, like, you, like, I guess it's like, if you ever watched anime growing up for a living, they don't explore, they explain certain things to your face a lot, but they also, there's a lot of stuff because of Japanese culture and the culture in which it's written. And I'm not gonna just on the culture, but when I say the culture, the storytelling style combined with the culture that Japan is, and I come from a collectivist culture as well, like, I'm Pacific Islander and it is different, but I kind of have an idea, is that most people don't say a lot of things. But second of all, it's also like, what a character, in anime, especially characters in anime, they don't necessarily say everything they feel, and people don't actually say everything they feel, and a story is not going to shouldn't tell you everything. If you never see something, sometimes you do kind of just have to assume. There's, for one thing, there's some fun in assuming. Whole fandoms have been made over just assuming that characters do something. You know, so, like, true. And it's kind of funny, it's a weird phenomenon where, for example, nobody actually wants to see Raylan and Callum in Angst and Canon. They want it in fic, but you can't have, there's like a, it's like an unspoken law of fandom. But, like, and so it's kind of similar with characters. It's like, your characters really should not say everything, and you don't need everything explained on screen. You don't need to see every moment. Sometimes you do have to, like, I don't want to say critical thinking, because that's kind of really harsh. I want to say, like, you have to think step at a time. Like, for example, Ezrin and Zubeya, why does he hang out with the woman that ordered the murder of his dad? Well, let's start with the fact that Ezrin is just really empathetic. He even forgave Claudia for, like, you know, trying to steal. Which, you know, Claudia is a whole other basket of things, but he forgives. He's always been super empathetic. And then you have the fact that he's really wise for his age. Then you have the fact that he is now king. And then you have the fact his goal is peace. He's just trying to create peace on the continent, you know, his way of doing that is to create these relationships. And at the end of the day, reason why that is that he can recognize that Zubeya was also in pain. Like, we're not going to just gloss over this idea, but you got to realize that Viren and Hera basically just, which was a horrible plan, by the way, the two of them rolled up to the storm spire. They rolled up there, no army, no nothing, but they just rolled up to this guy's house. They just rolled up there. And on that day, I'm not saying that Thunder was, you know, Avazander was a jerk. We know how complex he is in the show. Like, you know, he was seen differently by different people, and I'm long-winded, but they rolled up to this guy's house.
Yeah.
And then he tells him, hey, I'm not going to kill you today because my son was just born. So can you like go home? Like, I will let you go home like today. It's like, and it, regardless of the history of that, it's also like, okay, but you just rolled up to this dude's house on the day his son was born, and then you decide to kill him because 9 years ago you rolled up into a border that was established like 1,000 years ago and killed. It wasn't like you just strolled in there, you killed a Magma Titan innocently for good reason, but as the protector's idea, that's not going to matter to Thunder. And I don't think they contacted him. And so Zubeya's, and then Hera lets Viren basically kill his son. And so Zubeya lost her son and her mate in a day. Yeah. And it's like, that's painful. And it's like, they're both in pain.
I mean, well, you're kind of painting a really important context for a question that I have for this reflection. And I think that what you've just done is you've given the historical context of her pain. And that I think that if we aren't completing those stories in our head, then we're going to be missing out on underlying emotions in the scenes we watch, right? And sometimes those are holes that are meant to not be filled yet, right? And storytelling wise, like, it, there are certain things that we don't know for a reason. And so we don't know the complex emotion behind something. We can infer, we can guess, but like Callum's dad, for instance, we don't understand all of the problematic things that Callum experiences every time we think about his loss, because we don't know the full story. And so the color of his emotions is still unclear to us, but we can fill in those gaps. We can create the context outside of that, which is usually what fanfics do, is they create the context for which those emotions are.
Absolutely.
And I'm excited to kind of think about the context that you've just given us for emotion. So let's unpack what emotion is, just generally speaking. So I have the definition prepared from the American Psychological Association, which there are tons of definitions, and I did not like most of them, and I don't, you know, they're not all perfect, but here's this one. Emotions are conscious mental reactions, such as anger or fear, subjectively experienced as strong feelings, usually directed toward a specific object, and typically accompanied by physiological and behavioral changes in the body. I have so many problems with this definition.
I have one at least.
Yeah.
And for me, like, at the top, it's like conscious. Like, well, not all emotions are conscious, actually.
I
like,
agree. Yeah. Like,
honestly, a lot of, like, especially somebody describes it to me well perfectly, where it's like, it's like the soul, it's like about the soul trigger. It's like you've had the worst week of your life and suddenly you're trying to put salt on your food and it's not coming, so you just burst into tears. You're not conscious, like, you're not, it's not about the salt trigger, but a lot of emotions are unconscious. Like, you know, a lot of them stemming from trauma or whatnot in general, but just in general, like, we're not conscious about a lot of our emotions. It's there, we're just not conscious actively of them.
I read a study about emotions and specifically the quantity of emotions that people could name. And the majority of people can name three emotions: happy, sad, and angry.
Wow. Me looking at the feelings wheel every week.
Yeah. You like, I like the feelings wheel is a part of my vocabulary, right? And so the, you know, there's 60s, 70s, 80s of emotions on this list. And that's not even all of them. And so it's one of those things where for people whose work this is, it's one thing, but the reason I chose a Brené Brown quote is she put out a book recently called Atlas of the Heart, in which she is going through and writing out the definitions and the context for a bunch of different emotions, specifically geared towards helping people develop their emotional intelligence. And I like, there's just so many things about these definitions that I'm just like, but that's, And so I really appreciate how important it is, because you were talking about anime as a vehicle for storytelling and the, what that is rooted in, the way that story is told and what is withheld is just as important as what is said. And I think similarly, like the United States, culturally speaking, is a very emotionally ignorant group of people.
Tell me about it.
Like, and so what that means is people are feeling things and they're feeling something really intense and they don't have a name for it. And so they call it angry, or they call it sad, or they call it happy. But it's actually something completely different that like has a different repercussion. And I think that like there's so much we could dive into it with this as a topic, but let's just say that this lens is going to be interesting as we dive into this. Are you ready? Are we ready to dive in?
I think so. I really like how you define that, because I was like, yeah, actually, you know, like I said, I'm 29 now. I've gone through most of my life not being able to name a lot of my emotions until like the past few years, usually being very internally reflective, but it's like emotions are difficult. So I like that how you set that up. It's like, yeah, I didn't always have a name for whatever this chemical feelings I had inside, which what I call my chemical feelings, my intuition on the inside. So I am ready to dive into Esmond's chemical feelings.
I know, it'll be wild. And I think what's so cool about that too is there are a lot of magic systems in books and stories in which the power of names is really important. And I think about that a lot when I think about emotions too, because that one of the phrases I heard early on was, if you can name it, you can tame it.
This is true.
And so if you can name the emotion you're experiencing, it's not necessarily you're going to be able to tame it, but just knowing and being able to name it is going to give you more agency, power, capacity to grapple with that emotion, capacity to feel that emotion. In other words, taming it. So let's see if we can name some of what Ezrin is going through. I'm going to toss it straight to you. In this reflection, what is a moment of emotion that you want to discuss first?
I would say I want to really talk about actually the end of it, which is very uncharacteristic for Ezrin, but also it makes 100% sense. It's not even the coming up and finding it and dropping it. It's not the part of like, you know, like taming his, it's the part where he goes and he steps on it. And it's, and you might think at first, not even at first, but in a reflection, it might be like, oh, you know, this is him kind of like controlling it or what. But you have to remember in that passage, he also says that he wished he was bigger. He wishes he was better. It's like, this is a moment of genuine hurt and anger and fury and even and disgust, really, at this thing. Like, this thing is the herald that says that this arrow is what that came to Zabea, that was for to let the Dragon Queen know that, you know, the King of Catullus said this arrow basically was, I won't say directly connected, but it was like, this arrow said his father was dead. This was the thing that, this was the message, essentially. And so this thing disgusts him. He is a person. Esmond is a person. He is not a robot. The fact that he goes back and he lets himself feel this thing, and he feels bad about it. Like, here's the thing, he feels a little bit of shame over it because he says he wishes he was a bigger person, a better person. But he's a 12-year-old boy having this very real, very measured reaction.
Response.
It's extremely reasonable. Like you're, this was the thing that basically told the world, told the Dragon Queen, that his father was dead, that his father was assassinated successfully. And so the fact that he goes back and he steps, it's both like good that he feels that he lets himself do that. It's also a very real reaction of a human being. Actually, he took it extremely well, but a very real reaction. There is disgust, there is shame, there is anger, there's hurt in that step of just destroying the thing that ultimately signaled the very heralding of a very different life he probably ever thought he was gonna have.
Yeah.
He probably thought that his dad was gonna die an old man, and he would become king, you know, maybe when he was older, and that did not happen. He was in so many ways robbed of a very different life.
Yeah, so there's a specific passage that I think colors this really well. I'm gonna read it for us. It's right in the middle-ish, right when he first sees this arrow. Ezrin's throat tightened. He peered closer at the little knot of cloth, crimson and silky, tied around the arrow's shaft. The sight of it filled him with a sick unease that repelled him, but painful curiosity pulled him closer. He leaned down to pick the arrow up. And you are mentioning disgust being one of his primary emotions. And, you know, I think one of the things that is a common misconception around emotion is that one can separate our like mental processing of emotion from our body, i.e. that the brain is separate from the body. But in this paragraph, like, we see physical reaction from Ezrin in response to this. We see his throat tighten. We see sick unease. We see painful curiosity. Like, these are physical descriptors that are happening to Ezrin. And I think when we think about emotion, it's important to pay attention to the body and what those emotions do to the body. And not just in our reaction, like not just in our physical reaction, like throat tightening, and, you know, some first for me, when I get certain emotions, like my hands will start to tingle, or my armpits will start to sweat, or I'll start to feel hot, like lots of different physical reactions, but also when emotion leads to action, like what you're describing at the very end of this piece, like Ezrin turns around due to his feelings and goes and steps on this arrow. And that is a thought turning into emotion, turning into an action. And I think it's important to kind of recognize the relationship between our emotions, our thoughts, and our actions. And I'm curious if how that lands and resonates with you. What are your thoughts? And I talked a lot just now. What are your thoughts?
It's okay. I talk a lot too. Actually, I was just thinking about how, like, y'all gotta remember that, like, don't get me wrong, he has every right to step on it. Like, I get it. Yeah. You know, there is every right, but that ain't his arrow. That's not his house. He just went to go step on. Don't get me wrong. Again, he has every right to, you know, I don't think Zubea would or should have an issue with it. But you gotta remember also, like, it's like being here in somebody else's house.
Yeah.
And so him going to step on he's in a vault of treasures, essentially. It's a vault of, like,
well, this was kept for a reason, right?
Yeah, like it was kept. Like, it's a, like, how do I say, it's like going in and like just destroying something in somebody else's house. And it's like, well, it's not his arrow, but he has every right to step on it. My point of making it's not his arrow is that he, you know, how does he probably feel in that moment where it's like, he makes the decision to go back into this vault. And mind you, he's like being, he's in reverence, he's in awe when he gets down there. He goes back into that place that he just had reverence and awe for everything in there, and he destroys one of those treasures. Yes, it was, and granted, it was made by a moon shadow elf, but yes, he has every right to do it. But he went in to destroy, there's not an accident that he's in reverence and awe of everything when he first gets there. And then when he goes back and destroys one of those things, because one of those things, right after they start talking about how like the Siren Stone was very painful for Zubeya because he lost a friend, you know, and it's not an accident that is like, well, this thing reminds him of losing his father, because it was exactly the herald of that. So it's he makes a decision to destroy one of those things, you know, wishing he was a better person, but knowing that in his heart that he's like, I'm not he's not above this right now, and he should have. And the thing that's important too is like, it's a shame is not a good thing. It is also okay that you feel it. Like, how do I say, it's not okay, but it's also like, it is a perfectly natural human emotion to feel shame over your actions. That's why we feel guilt. You know, you should feel guilty if you took candy from a baby. You should feel ashamed of yourself. But it's like, it's often a terrible emotion, but it's okay that he's feeling that, because like, he, Ezrin has a complex set of emotions he is allowed to feel about his situation, you know.
I think that's really important to name too, is that specifically like that this is complex, like that we are looking at Ezrin's trajectory, and you named it, like in the beginning of this, it's awe, it's reverence, it's wonder, and those are all really like positive. And I hesitate to say I don't love, it's not a dichotomy between positive and negative emotions, I don't love that, and those are considered beneficial emotions, one might say. And the communication that disgust and anger and pain and fear, perhaps even in response to seeing this arrow, are also communicating something to him, that this dragon that he cares about it's reminding him of the complexity of his relationship. It's reminding him of the gravity of his responsibility in this role as king, right? It's there's a lot of potential responses to this. And to be like, I think a lot of people might read this and say that Ezrin's so one-dimensional because he's a sad boy and he goes and steps on the arrow, but there's so much more going on behind that, that it's impossible to name them all, right? Because there are so many different potential ways one could explain it, right?
Yeah, I'd actually even say that, honestly, sadness is even the number one thing. It's there, but it's not the, I would argue it's disgust. Like, it's always described as being repellent, of being, you know, a painful curiosity. Like, it is something he is repelled by. And it's like, so, and then on another note, it's like, there's this, I think people want to see Ezrin struggle with being king, and that is fine. The way he probably deals with it is very much the way a happy-go-lucky person would deal with it. He's kind of similar to Soren. They don't deal with those emotions really either in front of people or not even in front of people. They just try not to. They deal with it in a very different way, like, you know, cope in a very different way. But what I was going to say was that pain is a part of life. Like, being like, when I say talked about being about shame, being like, it's okay to feel it, it's like, that is a part of life. Being sad, being angry, being disgusted, being repelled, being shamed, are all a part of life. It is part of what makes us human. you know, that feeling. So it's like, Ezrin is a human being. He's a 12-year-old boy. You don't need to see every little thing he does, but he has those emotions. Those are a part of being a person. You can't really escape like those things. So the idea that like he doesn't have them, or he doesn't like, it doesn't seem to bother him, even kind of soar into some way where it's like, it doesn't seem to bother him. It's like, I promise you those things do bother them. They don't have to cope with them in the way that we think that because I think a lot of, in fact,
that is it right there.
Yeah,
I agree.
Yeah. A lot of people kind of want to see their characters cope in a very explicit way. And it's like, you got to understand, like half of comedians are all dealing with depression. You would not think that they are, that they are dealing with depression, but they are. It's because comedy is a coping mechanism. That's what they do. That's how they deal with it. Because in real life, pain is a part of life, and you have to find a way to function somehow, some way, or else you're not going to function. It's very much like maybe for Ezra, it's because he uses his day-to-day as being king as well. He probably doesn't dwell on it. He deals with it, and then he probably tries to move on. Half of the people listening are probably not, including myself a very long time ago, are they don't do that. They don't deal with it and then move on. You need to actually process emotions. They don't just go away because you decide not to feel them. That's not how that works. You actually have to feel your feelings. They're not going to go away. So Ezrin and Soren, very similarly, probably are dealing with them better than the rest of us. Maybe less so Soren. Not because of anything intelligence. It's just because I can't imagine that stabbing your father after your sister tricked you into stabbing your father and then finding out he died anyway after he was going to turn you into a monster is something that you just kind of,
walk away from unscathed. I was thinking about this too, and you're talking about comedians, right? I think that if Soren is literally canonically a comedian now, right? So in season 4, he does stand-up comedy, and I've thought about that with Soren. Like, it's often the people who are, I used to work at a residential summer camp, and it was always the kiddos that were the smiliest and happiest at camp that had the hardest backstories that we would learn from. And I feel that way about Soren, right? Yeah. Soren is just like constantly going for funny. But that's, I think, part of his way of coping with his world. I think you're spot on in that, because he's always ready to play. And for him, it's like, okay, I'm going to run down the stairs and I'm going to beat you all everything's like a race. Everything's like a little competition. Everything's this. And then until it's not.
There was a Tumblr post that I'm taking this from. So Tumblr user, if you happen to be listening to this, there's a post about the Princess Bride about Inigo Montoya. Probably saying that's incorrectly somehow. And how the entire movie, it's a joke. It's comedy. It's funny where it's like, you killed my father, prepare to die.
Yeah.
Until it's not a joke anymore. People kind of forget because that's eventually the joke has to end. That's the point. And that's what makes it hit harder. He says in the end, I want my father back, you son of a bitch. And that's how you sometimes use comedy. And mind you, I was a screenwriting minor, so some of that is starting to come in a little bit here, but that's kind of how you use comedy as a genre to make things hit harder, because in real life, especially in stories, everything is not bad and everything is not good. The bad parts are made harder, because of the good times you had. And so it's like people kind of forget also too, don't seem to realize, or the people probably don't know, The Dragon Prince is a comedy drama. That is actually one of its one of its actual genres. It uses comedy, yes, but it uses comedy as an effective way than to make these serious things all that much harder. Like, yep. Like we're focusing on Soren here a little bit, but here's the thing. It's like Soren having all these funny moments in the show with his dad, who is exhausted by him, makes it hit harder when his father actually kind of, in a way, I want to say abandoned him, because I'd argue it's neglect before, but abandoned him emotionally. And then, you know, and Soren decides to leave and that sort of thing. It's his funny moments with Claudia, where they're always joking. Even in season 4, they have a funny moment, but then it makes it all that much harder when he leaves his sister and he misses her. That's how you use comedy to drive drama home, because it hurts, because there was a time where it didn't hurt.
And it's not always, I 100% agree, but I'm bringing it back to Ezrin, right? In that it's a similar thought process for me with Ezrin, because we get him happy and laughing and loving and kind almost all of the time. Which it seems like unreal that he's so forgiving and so kind, and then we see this.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
But what that does is it makes it so that this like is intense. This sticks out. This means something. This, like, him turning around and going to step on this arrow is big for him.
Yeah, let's contextualize Ezrin here real quickly. This is a 12-year-old boy who became king at 10. He now has probably for the past 2 years been sleeping in his father's bed, the king's bed, by himself, where his parents used to be. He never knew his mother, so probably doesn't miss him the same way, but he probably used to come in this room where he would maybe greet his father. This used to be his father's room. This was the room probably his father died in. I don't know. It was, because it's the same. We saw in season 4, it's the same balcony. This was the room his father died in. So now, you always seem kind. You always seem happy. You always seem striving for peace. You always see him being like this good kid. He sleeps in his father's bed in the same room he died in and he grew up in and died in alone. His brother was kind of probably while there, probably going through his own emotional shit and probably closing off for about 2 years because of Rayla leaving. He is trying to create a relationship with Zadia so that the future of all of humans and his kingdom and the dragons will be at peace, so that there is no war. He's probably lonely. Like he's always been lonely. He's always been weird to other kids. Like his background is actually kind of sad. Like, yeah, he's rich, he's a prince, but he doesn't really have anybody. Even, don't get me wrong, he has Callum, but even Callum is kind of in his own little world this way. And Ezrin is kind of without Corvus and without even Soren, maybe now, because now he's Crown Guard. It's like he has nobody else to share this burden with. Like, yeah, he has Callum. Yeah. And Callum's got his own thing going on, and he has Corvus, and he has Soren, he has other people, he maybe has Opelli, but nobody actually understands what he is going through. Whereas if anybody else fucks up, it's not the end of the world. If he fucks up, it actually might be kind of the end of the world. At the very least, he's affecting a lot of them. His choices affect everyone. Can you imagine that at 12 years old? Does anybody even remember what they were doing at 12?
That's hard for an adult to handle, much less a 12-year-old.
We can barely do 40 hours a week consistently.
Like, I'm sitting over here like, don't give me that responsibility. I can barely handle myself.
Exactly. Oh,
God. My goodness. Yeah. Amazing. So the only thing that I think I want to poke into a little bit more is you kind of hinted at this, but I think there's two things. I think there is a reckoning that has yet to occur that I would like to see somehow, some way, between Zubeya and Ezrin. And you mentioned that, right? And I don't know that I need to see it, but I certainly want to. In terms of this is a big moment for Ezrin, and it seems as though it's a little odd for me personally to think about being in relationship with the person who's responsible for my father's death without having a conversation about it. And maybe the conversation happened already, but I don't know. It just feels interesting to me. And I'm curious what the, like, go ahead, lay it on me. What do you got?
So it's really interesting. So I'm going to talk about She-Ra for 2 seconds. If you haven't seen She-Ra, and granted, I haven't seen all of it, but I had friends who were like in the, who like watched the whole thing and everything. You know, we've discussed it. I've seen parts of it. But there is a part in the show, I guess, where Catra, and I don't know if you've seen She-Ra, where Catra basically is partially or either fully or partially responsible for Glimmer's mother's death. And I've always, and apparently they just kind of, this is not a bash on She-Ra, but they never really address it.
Yeah.
Glimmer and Catra just are friends at the end because she's cool with Adora. And I'm like, could not be me. I'd whoop somebody. It's on sight. Yeah. It is on sight. Now with Ezrin, here is a little bit of the difference. Granted, I'm always here for the drama. I would not mind seeing that. And I do understand when people have that perspective. And to some level, I'd agree. But with Ezrin, I always kind of see it as this. He is making an active choice to end the cycle, because that's what the whole show is about. The whole show is ultimately about ending the cycle of violence and hurt and pain in somebody, which, yes, is often the humans in the show, but you gotta remember Zubea is also like doing the same thing to another degree. But Ezrin is choosing to end the cycle. He is choosing to not hold this against her, and it is a little bit, to us especially, a little bit weird that she's, they're kind of close, but it's like what else is he to do, you know? Yeah. What is he supposed to do? Just for one thing, she's the queen of the dragons. They need to have some kind of relationship if they both want peace, and maybe the show, we have like 3 more seasons though, so maybe the show will address it a little bit more, maybe they won't.
Yeah.
But I think I see it as like he's making an active choice not to have that reckoning, because he wants, he's, in other words, again, as a 12-year-old, is trying to be the example for basically a kingdom, for an entire future of people. Yeah. Of what to, no, I'm gonna say, and I'm not gonna say every time if somebody murders your mom or your dad, you gotta forgive him every time or deal with it, but Ezrin's situation is different. His decisions are ultimately going, yeah, to decide the future of a lot of different people.
And I think that's what makes it so sad, is that if that is true, Ezrin is not having this conversation for what he believes will help his people. And it's not that I think I need to see the conversation. Mm-hmm. What I actually am craving for, as you were talking, this came to me, what I'm actually craving is Zubea acknowledging that, mm-hmm, the harm, right?
That's totally fair, honestly. And I completely get that, because I really love and those who are listening to this who know me know I do love acknowledgement of pain. That's something that I specifically crave, and when I write in my characters, I love, you know, the acknowledgement of pain and the fact that that person is right. That's my thing. And so I actually do agree with that. And granted, maybe it's happened over the last 2 years that we haven't seen, but I do get that idea that it's like wishing that Zubea would acknowledge it. And granted, I can see with Ezrin it being twofold. The fact that his decisions may decide a lot of things for his people, but then also he probably doesn't want to have a conversation, not gonna lie. Like a lot of us, when we go through actually things that are people, we don't actually want to talk about it unless we feel a certain way. Like it's different when I'm talking to my therapist about my most painful things versus where I'm talking to like my parents or, you know, like,
or the perpetrator of said things.
Yeah. Or like, you know, my friends or anything, don't get me wrong, and depending on the friends. And it's like, so it's like, when you're in the real world, like, do you like ask yourself, not you specifically, but just whoever's listening, ask yourself, do you actually like to talk about the things that are most painful to you? And really ask yourself, like, do you ever really, because most of my friends, and granted, a lot of us are designers, most of my friends I'm the direct one. I got to be like, this subsist hurts you because of this XYZ. And they're like, hey, we don't get, well, they don't get serious, but they're like, ha ha ha, you know?
Yeah. So that was my one. Now my two. One of the things I think I am taking as a potential site of learning is also from Zubeya at the beginning of the reflection. You know, it, when they're talking about it, it's like, aren't you going to come down? Zubeya is like demonstrating and showing that she is like sad and going down provokes certain memories, and those objects bring up those memories, and she does not want to experience them. And I think that what we're getting from her is I the same is true for many of us, right? Where we have things that we keep because for certain reasons. We have objects around our house that are painful, even. We have all kinds of things that come up, or memories that pop up on our social medias from histories on there. And what she's demonstrating for us is a boundary around how she allows herself to come in contact with the things that she knows provokes sadness in her. And I think what we're getting is a sense of perhaps some takeaways around potentially things that might be helpful. And I don't know, like, one potentially could argue that, like, nope, this is avoidance. This is really bad. One should address the things that are really harmful. But, like, it seems as though she has learned and is making choices for her own health and goodness and well-being. And I'm curious what your take is on this, what just in terms of the boundaries that she's setting around it.
So, like, she's technically not a person, but, you know, she acts as a person. Yeah. It's like, Zubeya is also someone who has gone through a great amount of pain, like losing Avizandum. Yeah. And think, well, first of all, I come from a family who lost their first child before I was born. So, unless you have, and so people kind of underestimate, it's like, and granted, she has her baby, but unless you have gone through the pain of losing a child, you do not actually understand what it actually does to you emotionally, physically. My parents, you know, he would be like 3 years older than me, so he'd be like in his 30s. They still, every birthday and every death anniversary, and he was one when he died, so every death, you know, anniversary, he was a baby, just like Ezra, I mean, Zim was. So they still celebrate and deal with those days. And the thing is, as Zim is almost, I wouldn't say a combination of my situation in a way, because I was the first born child afterwards, and I wasn't supposed to be born because apparently, like, medical reasons, you know, I wasn't supposed to be born. So I was like a miracle child. And then my brother came along as well. So we weren't supposed to be here, according to the doctors. They said my mother would never have children. And in a way, Zubeya shouldn't have had Zim, because if it were not for Rayla's parents convincing Viren that he could use it for his own power and own gain or whatever, or use it for a weapon against the Zadians, he would be dead. And so that changes you as a person. And then at the same time, losing Avizandum. And so setting boundaries around that is good. It's also like a very, and again, she's not human, but she effectively in some ways is human. It's a very normal thing that people do. People don't actually like to, it's like, again, how many of you listening actually like dealing with your feelings in your heart of hearts, in your full, raw, honest opinion? You're the only person probably in the room listening to this. So answer yourself, really ask yourself, do you actually like dealing with your painful feelings? Not really. Yeah. You probably want them acknowledged. And yeah, even then, some people don't want to acknowledge. You probably don't actually like dealing with them. And so it's very normal for people to avoid that. I'm not saying it's good. And I'm not saying that Zubeya maybe shouldn't deal with it. But Zubeya is also several centuries old. She's a little bit different than the rest of us.
Yeah.
But her boundaries around that are probably like, how do I say? It's normal. It's like, I don't want to be reminded of the friend I lost. I don't want to be reminded of the maid I lost. I don't want to be reminded of almost losing Zim again. Like, those are very, not even painful, like, they are very distressing emotions.
Yeah.
You can't filter that all the time.
No, I appreciate that. And I think it's helpful. And I appreciate you pointing us to the fact that Zubeya is not human. And I think what we can say, and I think we've parsed this out on the podcast before, but the difference between being human and being person, right? And I think what we can confidently say is that Zubeya has a personhood and is a person that we are able to engage with, is not human. And so ascribing human characteristics without careful consideration is difficult, but it's definitely worth considering learning from the person that is Zubeya. And so I wonder what people who are listening are taking away from that, and who knows, right? We may or may not ever find out what.
Yeah, in a way, that whole personhood issue is kind of like the issue of the series. Like, the reason why dark magic is a thing, it's a little controversial to talk about that, but, you know, at the same time, it's like, it's, they're not human, so are they people? And it's like, okay, obviously, like, for example, I know people say, like, dogs are people, and that's not what we're talking about. And I said, we're talking about the fact that Zubeya basically acts like a human. She acts very human. She is a person. She has a personhood. And the whole thing with dark magic is like, there's a whole best of them. In a way, it's like, that's almost why High Dragons be like, there's a level in which dark magic is a little bit like cannibalism, because, and again, trauma sites and everything making of your body, because the reality is that if Zubeya is just as intelligent, if many of these Zadian creatures have personhood just like you do, is that, especially in a magical sense, is that not in a way thematic cannibalism in the story? That's actually, it's like, is different. Like, how are elves really any different from you? Dragons are really more intelligent than the rest of us. They might even feel things that we can't feel,
right?
So, and obviously it's not just dragons, it's like, you know, how do I know the inner rich life the inner life of an adorer? Like, I don't know. And and it's not the same as like in real life, like you know, cows and chickens and stuff like that. That is different. Like, it's a different thing when you introduce magic into a world that changes everything, including the personhood issue. Because if this creature can do magic and you can do magic, then what does that mean?
Look at that. Wow. Man, we took several turns, and this has been a great conversation. I want to kind of pull us into our closing and our final segment, which is gratitude, one of my favorite things that we do on our podcast. And I would love to kind of invite you into this question. Who is a character from this story or from our conversation that you are thankful for, and why?
Oh man, I'm grateful for a lot of the characters. I'm trying not to just go straight to my favorite ones. But to some level, I am, weirdly enough, I am appreciative of, God, I'm trying to settle on. It's like, I'm kind of appreciative of Claudia in a way. I am kind of I have a complicated relationship with Clyde. I am very hard on her. I also am like, this girl's mental state is going south, further south than like a shooting star. I swear to God, like, she's justified, but she's not even really justified in a lot of her actions. But I appreciate her complexity because it really shows what, a multidimensional character that's like, this is what it's actually like when you slip into like a terrible situation. It's not as like, you know, it's not one dimensional. She's doing it, everything she's doing for her family. And that's sometimes all it takes. I'm also appreciative of I am appreciative of Ezrin. I like the fact that he, for one thing, I granted, as a black mixed Asian and Pacific Islander person, Ezrin is probably as close as I'm ever getting on media TV. So, like, I appreciate him and his design. I appreciate the fact that he is a young king. I appreciate that he's a young black boy who is very kind. I appreciate Hera for the same reasons, where it's like, these are black men, black boys who are gentle, who are very multidimensional. And people don't kind of, not to take away from the gratitude, but people don't think about the fact that recontextualizes, especially for me, that recontextualizes a character's entire, race does recontextualize them as a character, because there are certain things, it would be very different if Ezrin and Hera were characters who were very like angry and tough and, and that could be a very slippery slope depending on the character. So I really appreciate them for that. And Callum for the similar reasons, again, as a mixed person, I appreciate those things.
Yeah. Wow. So much gratitude. I am going to pick Soren. I probably would not have done that at the beginning of our conversation, but our conversation, specifically what you lifted up and reminding me about just comedians and how our emotions are affecting us, even if we can't see it in other people. And sometimes that's so true with Soren, and just because he's playing the comedy act doesn't mean he's not feeling things. And I just appreciated that reminder from our conversation today. So I'm grateful for Soren and for people who are doing their best and bringing joy to the world, even in their darkest moments. And that brings us to our close. We are really thankful, Kuno, that you were willing to join us. I would love if you would like to be found. How would you like people to find you?
Well, thank you for having me on, first of all. So I am on Tumblr, Kuno-chan, kuno-chan.tumblr.com. On Twitter, I am, my user technically is kuno_12. I would like to change that one day. But for now, that's what it is. And it says Tamika Kuno. And on Instagram, though I'm not really on there very much, it's I am Kuno. And you can find me probably more on Twitter or on Tumblr most of the time.
Amazing. And is there anything you're working on that you'd like to promote or share?
You know, this, it's funny. I would say I'd always wanted to be asked that question, and then I don't really, I mean, I am working on like trying, if you ever see me, you know, just follow me, and if you ever see me promoting my Indigenous fantasy novel, you know, either maybe through traditional publishing or self-publishing or in some other form, maybe you take an interest in it one day. So it's almost like an IOU.
Yeah, like I'm gonna cash in that later on. Amazing. Well, everyone, you can also find us on all of the social medias at BNB_pod. Would love to give a shout out to our newest patron that signed up today as of the day that we're recording this. Thank you, Koyatala, for signing up. Really thrilled to have you in our Patreon community. You too can join our Patreon by finding us at BNB_pod and supporting us. We do monthly live episodes talking about Avatar The Last Airbender. We're in the middle of season 2. Our next episode is Appa's Lost Days, folks. That's a great episode to jump in on, so don't be scared. But other than that, it's been an incredible journey. Kuno, once again, thank you for being a part of this. I'm really grateful for our time together. And everyone, until next time, be well and do good.